supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have one of those jam-packed shows for you, cats and kittens. In a little bit, we will talk to Andrew Moore, author of the new book, Paw Paws, In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit. In time for Valentine's Day, we will also help you decipher the floral code, the ancient language of flowers that uses horticultural material to convey your feelings to another. That's a lot to get done, so we better convey right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sarah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm so excited to talk to you.
I'm so excited to talk to you, Sarah. Where are you?
I am located in East Kensington, Philadelphia.
Kensington used to be dead center of all the blue-collar row home factory workers, blue-collar workers. And now it's one of the trendiest areas in the city.
Yeah, it is. It's really blowing up. It's kind of crazy.
So what can we do for Sarah in a hot corner of Philadelphia?
So I have a fiddle leaf fig tree. Ficus lyrata. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Heck if I know. I failed Latin six times. <Yeah. laughs>
I took Latin. I should know. So I have this tree that I rescued. And when I received it, it was pretty sparse with leaves, very tall and thin trunks. And I rescued it around the end of the summer. When I got it, I ended up sticking it outside, giving it some fresh fertilizer and compost, and watered the heck out of it. And it basically came back to life. And then I brought it in, obviously, at the end of summer, and it's been in my house over the course of, you know, the past couple months. It's been cooler out here, so I've had the heat on.
Is it near the heat?
Well, it was near the heat. I had left for a long weekend, and my boyfriend had turn the heat up super high. Yeah. So the leaves were dropping like crazy. But my main question is about pruning and feeding it and repotting it and possibly propagating it.
This thing was dead 6 months ago, and now you want to breed it? You have you have high expectations.
A lot of my friends have them, and they seem to be kind of tricky.
They are among the easiest houseplants of all if you don't fuss with them. Fussing meaning things like pruning for no good reason other than you're bored and you're lost your Uno cards and feeding with harsh chemical salts, which the plant was never exposed to and can't get rid of because it's in a pot.
Mm-hmm. So the pot has drainage. I didn't repot it, but it's in a pretty big pot. I would like to replant it because I'm not really sure if it's root bound or what's going on.
No, you're bored. You are suffering.
I'm bored?
Yes, you are suffering from the most common problem of indoor and outdoor gardeners who think that no plants existed on this planet 600 years ago. And obviously, we have to be helicopter parents hovering over them, constantly doing everything to them. Figs indoors are like figs outdoors in the Mediterranean. They are just best left to their own devices, as are most plants. It wants decent light, but not too much direct light. It doesn't want to broil in the sun. Avoid repotting is the first word in the indoor plant care books on ficus.
Now that I've brought it inside, it's looking kind of sad and...
Well, that's because
really
that's because of the thermostat wars. You know, you can go to the hardware store and buy one of those boxes with a lock on it and put it over the thermostat, and that'll probably do better for your fig. Keep it away from any direct heat sources. Water it only when the plant has almost completely dried out. Figs like to dry out in between waterings. They don't want to be in soaking wet soil. They don't want to be near any heat sources, any radiators or hot air vents. But they.
What about it getting cold, like if it's by a window and it's getting too cold?
Well, they do like cooler nighttime temperatures, like in the 50s. If you think there's ice forming on the window, then it's probably too cold there. And the answer there is not to do anything with the plant, but to get one of those plastic insulator kits and, you know, cover over the window for the winter.
Okay.
And the last thing is mist it. If you want to do something, you can mist it in the morning. It would love that. Just a gentle plant misting. Okay. Keep the leaves nice and moist without keeping the roots soaking wet.
Okay, great.
But what I want you to do is get the plant away from heat sources. Don't let it freeze at night. Don't overwater it. Don't repot it, but do mist it every day. Let's keep this puppy alive before we start having babies.
Okay, cool.
Go All right.
Okay.
So take good care of this fig and do some research, and then in the spring you can start trying various things of propagation. The best way to learn this is to fail.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck, Sarah.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. I'm pleased to be on your show.
I'm pleased to have you, Bob. Where are you, man?
I'm in Oklahoma City.
All right. So what can we do for Bob in OKC?
Well, I have just made myself a raised garden. It's about 3 feet by 20 plus feet. I built it over a place that before had Bermuda grass growing, and I turned it over by hand and tried to get most of the roots of the Bermuda out. Now I'm hauling in manure and topsoil to put on the top, and I'm going to rototill it all in. But the dirty little rascal Bermuda grass always comes back, even when you think you've got it.
Okay.
And so my question is, I was going to take the black plastic.
No, I can just stop you here and tell you that you are your Bermuda grass's best friend. One of the reasons we build raised beds is that so we can sell the tiller on eBay. Once you have a nicely defined raised beds, and yours are only 3 feet wide, there's no reason you should ever have to step on the soil inside of them. So there's no reason for you to have to till, whether you're using compost and topsoil, compost and manure, topsoil and manure, whatever your mixture is that you're going to fill the beds with or refresh them, you don't want to till it into your existing soil, you know, for many reasons, the biggest one being that's where all the billions of little rhizome parts that you've missed are still lurking. I knew that, Bob. Grass is the biggest enemy of especially a flat earth gardener. But you have achieved the PhD level, Bob. You've made grass your enemy in a raised bed garden. That's really up there. That's Olympic level.
Okay.
Now, are these beds empty, or do they have some soil mixture in them already?
Well, it's empty except for just one little corner where I started.
Okay,
and,
good.
Basically empty.
Okay, good. Because if you had read our online article in the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website on raised beds, you would have learned that one of the easiest ways to keep that grass under control is once you've excavated the area, and it's a good idea to have tilled it up underground and gotten as much of the root system out as you can, then you level that area out at ground level and you lay down a single sheet of cardboard. Now, this can be overlapping sheets from all the Amazon boxes you got, or, you know, maybe you find a good refrigerator size box somewhere that you just have to cut it to size. But line the entire bottom of your raised beds at ground level with cardboard, and then put the new material, whatever it's going to be, on top of the cardboard.
Oh, okay.
The cardboard is going to be better. You don't really want plastic under there. Plastic, I know you guys don't get a lot of rain normally. I think you've been pummeled quite a bit in the last year or so. When you get a heavy rain, if you had black plastic under there that was not shredded, it would be like a bathtub. You'd be defeating the great drainage function of raised beds. But cardboard is going to let the water leak through or around the edges and stuff like that. It's not going to pool up, but it's going to provide a very good barrier against the grass. And then if you've got a good 12 inches of soil or soil-like mixture on top, that weight on top of the cardboard will prevent even an aggressive grass from coming through. I mean, maybe after a couple years, you'll see a little runner coming up one of the sides. They love to send scouts up to the sides and come up that way, but that won't be any problem.
Okay.
But that's the basic answer, is line the bottom with cardboard before you fill it with whatever you're going to do.
Well, great, because I was wondering what exactly I should do. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bob. I got to be right at least once during this show. That's like put a little check mark there. All right. Good luck, man.
All right. Thank you. Goodbye, bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will soon appear at the Brandywine 100 Library in North Wilmington, Delaware. That'll be on Wednesday evening, February 22nd. And at the Capitol Garden Show in Chantilly, Virginia, later that week on Saturday and Sunday, February 25th and 26th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to talk with the author of a new book on pawpaws, reveal the secret language of flowers, and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we are on the eve of Valentine's Day, man. So, in honor of that, we will discuss the horticultural code known as the language of flowers, in which you will reveal your feelings by the posies you pick. We're also going to take more of your fabulous phone calls, but now it is time to bring on our very special guest, Andrew Moore, the author of Pawpaw, In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit, which is just out in paperback from Chelsea Green Publishers. Andrew, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Now, I'm going to throw something out at you to begin with that we haven't prepared you for, but I'm going to try it anyway. Can you sing the Pawpaw song?
Oh, boy. I'll kind of just give you the lyrics. It's, where, oh, where is little Andy way down yonder in the pawpaw patch? Picking up pawpaws, put them in your pocket. How's that for a rendition?
I thought it was picking up pawpaws, putting them in a basket.
See, that's one of the things I really like about the pawpaw is there's all this confusion, and everyone has their own version of the story, and that's one of them. That song, putting them in your pocket, putting them in your basket. If you've handled pawpaws, you know that putting them in a pocket is probably kind of not a good idea, especially with such a soft, pulpy fruit.
So let's drop back. There are two large Native American fruits, the persimmon and the pawpaw. When I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, our readers were enthralled by pawpaws, which is something you found throughout the country, that people who had tasted them when they were children, when they heard the word again, they went all crazy-eyed, right?
That's right, yeah. There's two kinds of people who are enthralled with them. There's the folks that remember them from their childhoods, you know, whether this was 40 or 70 years ago when they had their last taste of it. And then when someone mentions it, they get all, you know, wispy and they miss the fruit and they're excited about it. And then there's folks like myself who didn't grow up with it, didn't know about it. And when they're introduced to it, they find it incredible that such a unique, large, good tasting fruit would be so unknown. And so folks like myself and so many others, they get really excited about it. And they do things like write a book about it.
As you did, In Search of the Pawpaw here. Now, this is a fruit that's hard to describe, let's be honest. I know it goes by a million different names. Back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening, most people called it the, quote, banana of the North. But in your book, you make clear that different trees will have fruits that will have radically different flavors. So first describe the leaves of these small trees, and then do your best to describe the fruit.
The first word that comes to mind for both the tree, the leaves, and the fruit is tropical. That word gets used a lot because I think it is so unique in flavor, the fruit, that we just need a word to say it's otherworldly. You know, it doesn't taste like Ohio. It tastes like tropical. And the leaves are among the longest and broadest of the eastern deciduous forest. Only some of the magnolias, broadleaf magnolias, are bigger. So it's a tropical-looking broadleaf tree. The leaves are often a foot in length, if not longer. Just this really gorgeous look to it. And then the interesting thing about pawpaw and what sort of our generation is doing is we're taking them out of the woods. And we're putting in prominent places in the landscape and in some cases in an agricultural setting. And when you put them in the full sun, they get this pyramidal shape, and they can get as tall as 30, 40 feet. And they can get to be this really big, monumental size. And they just have such a good shape and structure.
But that's
just the tree, not the fruit.
Right, but that's not their nature. One of the things that is going to be most appealing to our listeners is this is one of those rare fruits that grows in the understory, in the shade of larger trees, like black walnuts.
That's right. And, you know, mentioning black walnut, it's not bothered by growing with black walnuts specifically. That's another good thing about it. But exactly right. Its native niche is the understory. That's where it's found. And you know, it will set fruit in the understory. So from a gardener's perspective, you can make it work in a shadier setting that another fruit tree wouldn't work. But again, what I sort of like about the pawpaw is it can kind of fit wherever you want it to. You can also put it in full sun, and it will also do well and produce even more fruit in full sun. So it's very flexible for the gardener in terms of, well, you know, where do you need this thing? And more than likely, it's going to do well in just about any condition.
And when you, quote, found your first pawpaw, when you went into the woods on your, quote, first pawpaw hunt, you did not see it first. You smelled it.
Yeah, I you know, I'm remembering back, and that may have been true. I saw the tree. I didn't see the fruit at first. And it hides behind those large tropical leaves that I was describing earlier. So it can be hard to see. But then you start to smell it when you're in the woods, especially if there's a good crop. And what a lot of folks do, because they can be sort of hard to spot, and if they're growing high up on the tree, is you just shake a pawpaw, the tree itself. And again, you know, we mentioned they don't get very big in the woods, and so you can wrap your hand around it and shake it. And the ripe fruit, if it's ready, it'll fall. And it may fall on your head, it may roll down a hill, but you can shake it and get that fruit.
To discuss the taste, I'm going to read you some of your own words. Squeezing some pulp into my mouth, I sensed first the texture, like custard, smooth and delicate. Then the flavor, which was truly tropical, with hints of vanilla, caramel, and mango. Then I ate another one, and it tasted like a melon.
That was probably fruit gathered from a different couple trees. And that was sort of my bounty as I had gathered everything from the woods that day and piled them in my shirt and took them out of the woods and I set them down. And, of course, I'd lost track of what fruit came from where because I was full of excitement. That was, in fact, you know, my first pawpaw experience. And so this is fruit likely from different trees. But also, as the fruit ripens, the flavor dramatically changes. It's certainly more mild the greener it is. And then as it ripens and the skin will darken, it develops those caramel, brown sugar, very dark and sweet flavors. Even fruit from the same tree picked at a different time or left to ripen a little bit longer will taste different.
And you say some old-timers will take ripe fruit back to the house and they'll let it sit out until it turns jet black. And they claim that that's the best tasting fruit of all.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, talking to some of these older folks who have these old stories of pawpaws was probably some of my favorite things to do because they did some real interesting things with pawpaws. One gentleman said that he would wait till it got black and then started to taste fermented, and he said it tasted like pawpaw wine. And another gentleman who would allow the fruit to ripen to that dark, overripe state and then eat the skin even, which most folks don't do. But yeah, so different strokes for different folks when it comes to eating pawpaws.
Now, the pawpaw is a fruit that ripens up for a period of like 30 days at different times in different parts of the country, but generally as we're approaching or into fall, right?
That's right. Late summer, early fall, kind of with the mid-Atlantic being the middle of the pawpaw range, its ripening month more or less is the month of September. So, you know, the further south you go, the earlier. And in states like Michigan, where there's native pawpaw stands as well as some small pawpaw farms, you have fruit pretty much all of October.
But am I correct that Pittsburgh is just outside the range of pawpaws?
So, you know, it's a funny thing when you look at the USDA's distribution map for the pawpaw. It's not the northernmost point for pawpaw because pawpaw's native range extends into southern Michigan.
Right, but I'm looking at a map here, and it's almost cruel. It's almost like somebody cut out the color right where you live.
You're exactly right, yeah. So this edge, the natural historic distribution, ends right around Pittsburgh. So whenever I go pawpaw hunting, I have to go south. I have to go towards West Virginia. And
or into Ohio.
Or into Ohio, certainly, just towards the Mason-Dixon line, you know, it's further south, And really following the Ohio River is where some of the most abundance of pawpaw and really quality pawpaw. Historically, looking at, you know, some of these 100-year-old contests to find the best pawpaws and even, you know, Native American cultures that had celebrated pawpaw, that Ohio Valley and in fact, Ohio, the state of Ohio itself, has some of the great pawpaws from a historical viewpoint.
And this is a, quote, river tree. It's found in damp, shady areas.
Yeah, not exclusively along creeks and rivers. There's certainly, you know, upland sites where you'll find pawpaws, but they're often found there. It's, you know, for various reasons, and, you know, we can speculate that likely water transport of seed, you know, fruit rolling down hills and getting transported by rivers and creeks. And so when you look at some place names around the country, you do find a lot of pawpaw creeks and pawpaw rivers named for likely the native stands of pawpaws that grew along those places.
And this plant has been growing wild in North America for, you say, untold millions of years.
Yeah, it's found in the fossil record. It may date as far back as 56 million years ago. The exact date isn't placed, but that's the period it belongs to. And the fossil record of that period, pawpaws are found in diverse sites like Mississippi and New Jersey, so quite a distance there. But there is evidence of pawpaw in the fossil record that long ago. There's the Meadowcroft Rocks Shelter had been the oldest site in North America. That's just south of Pittsburgh. I know there's some new sites that are, you know, taking away that honor, perhaps. But pawpaw seeds and twigs and leaves and things were found in the fossil record there. I don't think that they dated back to the very beginning of maybe of you know, the 17,000 years ago in that particular site. But they were found at that site, and the really sort of poetic thing about that site is today pawpaws are still there, growing along the creek just outside of the Meadowcroft rock shelter there. The earliest Americans that were at that site may have and certainly did likely eat pawpaws there, and that same species is there today.
Now, if a gardener wants to grow a pawpaw, are they true to seed, or do you not know what you're going to get, like with apples?
They're like apples, though some folks may suggest that the genetic sort of likelihood of getting a good pawpaw from a good pawpaw fruit is higher perhaps than apple. They are not true to seed, though. So the only way to clonally propagate them is through grafting at this point.
Right, and that's probably the smarter money, because the seed would take 8 years to grow to a size to produce fruit, right?
Right, and time is money. So, you know, if there are a number of great nurseries that offer grafted pawpaw trees, I have an appendix in the back of my book.
I was just looking at the named some. At the named varieties even that you go over. But before we get to that, there are a couple plants like this, and I know they fascinate people. And this was something I honestly did not know about pawpaws, is they are not pollinated by bees. They are one of these plants whose flowers put out a carrion stench to attract flies.
That's right. Yeah, flies and beetles, the same insects that are attracted to carrion, you know, decomposing flesh. And so it's led some writers to say that the pawpaw flower smells like rotting meat. Now, I've stuck my nose in many a pawpaw flower, and I've never detected rotting meat. But it's certainly a yeasty sort of scent. And in fact, in my research, I connected with a scent scientist who identified the scent as rising bread dough or red wine, which are, you know, sort of yeasty, nope, fermented odors that we actually find quite pleasant.
I was going to say, yeah. Well, but then again, when I have red wine open and the compost crock is too full, the fruit flies go for it like mad. So
there you go. Yeah, it's doing its job then.
And is this, could it possibly be true that the pawpaw leaves are the only host for the larva of the zebra swallowtail butterfly?
This is what the scientists tell us. They are the only host for that beautiful, beautiful, striking zebra swallowtail butterfly. So if you needed one more reason to plant a pawpaw, there you go.
I was shocked to see how many named varieties you list with characteristic descriptions in the back of the book. And I'm presuming these varieties are all available from one source or another.
The ones that I list are available. There's even more pawpaws from an earlier generation cultivars that have likely gone extinct, that we just don't have those cultivars anymore. And every day, you know, if someone finds a good pawpaw in the woods, if they're hiking on along a river or a hill and they find a good pawpaw, they could name that thing and sort of introduce it to the trade as their own cultivar.
And they have great names. These are like heirloom tomatoes. I'm looking
they
at
do.
Green River Bell, Halvin's Sidewinder, Kentucky Champion. That has to be the name of a tomato as well. Mary Foo's Johnson, Naomi's Delicious. But again, we have to emphasize that the harvest period is really short, and the picking window is even shorter than that. This is like having a dairy farm. You can't go on vacation. I think one of the things you say that's a clue in your region, when you see goldenrod in the fields, the pawpaws are ripening up.
That's right. It's time to start looking for them. You know, if you're a wild harvester, and certainly in your orchard, it's time to check on them. But certainly if you have an orchard, you're thinking about them before you see the goldenrod. But yeah.
And when it's ripe, you just sit down, you bust it open, and you eat it with a spoon and you spit out the seeds.
That's my way to go at it. I like to eat it fresh. It's my preferred way. You know, these things at this point anyway, they're hard to come by. And so when I get one, that's all I like to do is crack it open and eat it with a spoon.
Yeah, and
but it makes a good ice cream as well.
Yeah, so you've got an ice cream recipe. You got a beer recipe. But I sense that during the writing of this book, you developed a pretty bad pawpaw habit.
I did, yes. You know, but every year, it seems, I'll confess to you, towards the end of pawpaw season, I've kind of had enough. I've had enough pawpaws.
But you filled the house with so many, the smell remains until Christmas.
Yeah, well, that may be some exaggeration, but it does linger. And, you know, my car has smelled like pawpaws for days.
I think Andy Moore needs a 12-step pawpaw group here. All right, and I want to tell people that there are many other aspects to your book. You talk about all the county fairs, all the pawpaw celebrations around the country, how they've fruits have found their way into farmers' markets. You cover a lot of ground, and it's a very entertaining book. We recommend it highly. The name of the book is Pawpaw, In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit. The author is Pittsburgh's Andy Moore. It is published by Chelsea Green Publishing. You can find the hardcover for sale now, and the paperback will be out shortly. Andy, I will see you when I give the keynote talk at the Phipps Conservatory on October 14th in Pittsburgh. I'll be out your way, and maybe we can get together when I come on out.
That sounds great. I'll try to put the best pawpaw in the fridge and save it for you.
Pawpaws in Pittsburgh. I got the name of my talk. All right, Andy, it's been great having you on You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the Master Gardeners Spring Symposium in Fayetteville, North Carolina on March 25th. And then I will be in beautiful State College, PA, April 6th through the 8th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to reveal the secret language of flowers and take more of your flowery phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a few minutes, we will discuss the floral code, the secret language of flowers that allows you to use a bouquet to express your true feelings without words, just in time for you to get it right on Valentine's Day. You don't want to miss it. And you won't. It's coming up after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Andrew, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being had, Andrew. Where are you, sir?
Avondale, Pennsylvania, southern Chester County.
Oh, okay. Out by Longwood Gardens and the Delaware border and all that?
Yes, sir.
All right. Beautiful horticultural area. What can we do for Andrew in Avondale?
Well, Mike, I have been trying to figure out how to identify sycamore saplings because I would love to plant one in my parents' yard. You can obviously tell the large ones, but it's hard for me to find younger ones. And I've even tried to propagate them from seed before with no luck. I'm not sure exactly if I'm doing it correctly, but I tried.
So, and you're totally against the idea of actually buying a young sapling or joining the Arbor Day Foundation and getting five of them the size of a pencil, you know?
Well, I wasn't quite aware of that, but that is definitely something to look into.
We've had a lot of calls this winter, people who joined the Arbor Day Society and didn't realize the size of the trees they were going to be sent as their special gift. You know, there are really small saplings out there, things that are like a year or two old that you can pick up very cheaply if you look around. I doubt your local garden center would have anything that wouldn't be 4 or 5 years old. But then again, without asking your age, sir, did you hope to see this thing at a good size?
I've always wanted to see a 40 or 50 foot sycamore in the front yard, but I think that would take a few more years.
Well, it would take 30 to 40 years from seed. But were you to start with a high quality small tree, you'd have what I expect you want, which is that kind of dramatic exfoliating bark, the beautiful fall color, and just a very muscular tree. I think you'd have a specimen out there, the beginning of one in 5 years, and certainly a real enviable one in 10.
I should hope I'm still alive to see it.
Right, exactly. Whereby if you identify a seedling out in the woods and bring it home, it's really going to be 5 to 7 years before it's even a couple of feet tall. These are slow growers. These are long-lived trees.
Okay.
And one of the things people don't take into account, and this is a fun thing to do, I mean, and you can identify them. I mean, the key would be to, you know, to look under existing sycamore or, quote, plane trees, P-L-A-N-E, because they're essentially the same family. And look for, you know, when the tree leafs out, you want the leaves up in this tree with this great bark to look a little bit like maple leaves, but not exactly. And then the saplings under that are probably going to be that parent, unless a squirrel got frisky. But during the time that you would be growing out this small tree, the 10 years it would take to get it to a size where it would look in place in a front yard, you'd have to protect the bejesus out of it from rabbits and deer. A deer will still attack a full-grown sycamore. They love to rub their antlers. They love to velvet their antlers against a tree whose bark gives way naturally. But while that tree is still in its first 5-10 years of life, it's rabbit food, it's deer food, it's groundhog food. It would have to be really strongly protected, whereby if you start out with a tree that's, you know, like 5-10 years old, then you still need to protect it somewhat, but it's not like you're putting a 6-month-old infant in your yard and checking on it every couple of days, you know?
Gotcha. Okay, now, if for fun, I wanted to try from seed, do you have any tips for that?
No, but there is a wonderful reference guide called Historic American Trees. This is the life story of a guy who propagated the tree that Abraham Lincoln gave the Emancipation Proclamation underneath, the tree that grew outside Amelia Earhart's childhood bedroom window that she climbed in, all of these wonderful historic American trees. And as he describes them, he talks about how to propagate them from cuttings and how to grow them out from seed.
All righty. Well, that sounds good.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Thank you, Mike.
1-888-346-9499. Ed, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Ed. How are you, man?
I'm having a pretty good day. How about yourself?
I am just ducky, thank you. Where is Ed having his good day?
I'm currently located in Sewell, New Jersey.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Ed in the Garden State?
I have six little miniature lime trees.
Right.
And I started this project just this past year. I purchased them. I actually intended to buy one, but then it went on sale, so I got a few more, and I put them in pretty large pots with really good soil.
Mm-hmm.
They're like 20 inches or 22 inches by 22 inches. And in maybe October, I moved them into the house in direct sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
And three of them have done really well. They have their leaves. They continue to produce these little limes. Actually, I take that back. One has produced limes. And three of them have lost all of their leaves, and one of them looks even a little sickly. And I thought maybe it was the vents, and I moved them so that there was nothing blowing on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to help a little bit, but it hasn't changed things.
No, I think you're already understanding the care of these plants. Now, when you say you repotted them into this monster pot, now I will tell people that a 22-inch pot, that's like the size you see outside of hotels. Because I actually grow tomatoes and birds of paradise in 17-inch pots, and they're difficult to move around. Do you have all six plants in one pot?
They're all in individual pots, and yeah, they're a project to move them on the bottom so that they can be moved. Little things that have four wheels.
Right, casters, dollies. Yeah. Okay. But aren't those pots too big for the plants? Don't they look out of place?
No, I mean, they've grown, I mean, I think it's the goldfish principle. They've gotten to be big enough that they're at least a foot and a, maybe 2 feet high, and a couple of them have branched out, so they're beyond the limits of the border of the pot.
Excellent. Okay, so I think you're doing great. Next year, you might want to bring them in a little bit earlier. You don't want them to be exposed to nights below 50 degrees.
Oh, okay.
So forget about the calendar, because everything you read is going to be calendar-oriented, and that's not the way it works. Tropical plants, which includes my bird of paradise, seasonal tomatoes, peppers, your citrus trees. Obviously, they die if it goes below freezing, but they get right. All moody and depressed at nighttime temperatures below 50 degrees outdoors.
Okay.
So there is nothing to be lost by keeping them inside a little bit later and moving them back in a little bit earlier. When they're outside, they do want full sun. When they're inside, they want the brightest light possible. Now, even though they are tropical plants and don't have a true dormant period, they do like cooler temperatures in the wintertime. So 50 to 55 degrees is perfect for them in the winter. And obviously it's going to be much warmer for them outside in the summer. But that change of temperature is very good at triggering flower development and fruit formation. Don't be afraid to have the room they're in a little cool.
Mm-hmm. In the summer, I watered about once or twice a week,
mm-hmm.
Really full water. And then because they got a lot of sunlight, but now I don't know whether to like water them every 2 or 3 days, water them once every 2 weeks, or somewhere in between.
Well, you know, that's one of the problems with your large size pots. You can't really rock them to tell, you know, how much they
right.
weigh, whether they're light or whether they're heavy. Are the pots made of terracotta as well?
Yes.
Oh, man, yeah. So terracotta is going to wick moisture into the air. The drier your home, the more you're going to need to water the plants. So in your situation, you may want to buy one of these little gauges that tells you the saturation level of the soil and just move it from pot to pot. But one good way to cheat is to get a good mister and mist the plants down with just plain water. Every morning, just really soak their leaves with fresh, clean water. They absolutely love that.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And then when you water, try to water deeply. In terracotta, they're going to need more water, but the threat of overwatering is going to be less because the pot is always going to be drying out. So misting and keeping away from heat sources, and I think you're on the road to having mojito makings all year long. You just got to go out and plant the mint.
It's all about the margaritas.
Okay, there you go.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, good luck, Ed.
Thanks, bye.
All right, as promised, it is time for the question of the week. How to use the language of flowers this Valentine's Day. Alexis Landis, even though it's not a question, get us started on this week's very special bit of information.
So, this week's question is more of an answer for people who didn't know to ask.
That's right. The timing of the show is perfect for us to play Cupid, as we will neatly precede Valentine's Day in just about every market that airs the show on broadcast radio. And we'll also convey this essential information to folks who promptly pick up on our podcast.
And this essential Valentine's Day information is...
how not to send the wrong horticultural message in the floral code, the, quote, language of flowers that was immensely popular in the Victorian era, when manners and station often prevented direct talk of romance, and symbolism was the only socially acceptable way to express your feelings.
That is so romantic. Do traditional red roses send the wrong message?
Not really. Regular red roses do symbolize love in general. Hey, and here's an interesting kicker. The more thorns on a presented bouquet of red roses, the more passionate the love.
And the more dangerous.
Passionate love is always dangerous. Now, you want to avoid rose colors other than the basic red. White roses symbolize chastity, which is perhaps not your intended point on February 14th. Peach-colored roses mean sympathy, which might be what you'll wind up needing, but don't ask for it up front. Yellow roses are the worst. That color translates to, let's just be friends. Oi! For this I spent $30!
What about those really fancy, velvety red roses?
They symbolize bashful shame, which again may be true, but you know.
So then... do basic red roses with lots of thorns convey the most direct romantic message?
Nope. Only red tulips specifically mean I love you in the floral code.
Tulips?
Yep, red ones. Not exactly sure why, but this was supposed to be a secret code. And how harmless is it to give somebody a little bouquet of tulips in the early spring, right?
That is pretty clever. And I do see tulips for sale in florist shops and grocery stores around Valentine's Day. And some of them seem to be live bulbs growing in pots of soil.
Yeah, they're very popular in that form these days. And you can even try and, quote, naturalize them. This wouldn't work for a lot of potted bulbs, but dirt basic red tulips are some of the most reliable spring bulbs at naturally returning year after year. Now, whether you get them cut or potted, you want to pick plants whose flower heads are tightly closed, displaying that really classic tulip shape. Take a pass on tulips whose petals are wide open. Those flowers aren't going to last more than another day or two.
And what's the procedure for getting the ones in pots to rebloom in the future?
Well, first of all, you want to display potted or cut tulips in normal room light, not direct sun. Matter of fact, the cooler the room, the longer the flowers are going to last. And either way, you want to water sparingly. Now, with potted plants, after the flowers fade, cut off the very top of the flower stalk with scissors, just below the little bulge that would have become a seed head if you didn't do this. Ditch any decorative foil around the pot and put it in your brightest, sunniest window. Although direct sun will fade the flowers, it feeds the green leaves. Give the plants a little natural food like an inch of compost or worm castings on top of the soil and water when the pot feels light.
What if you don't have a sunny window? Can they just go outside?
Oh, yeah, spring bulbs are cold-loving plants. You can place the pot outside in a sunny spot and just leave it there as long as the nights stay above freezing. You want to bring it back inside temporarily when and if nights get really freezing cold or ice storms are predicted. Now, whether it's outside or in a sunny windowsill, feed it again around May 15th. Let those green leaves grow and absorb sunshine until their color fades. Then just bring the whole schmagegi back inside and put it in a cool basement or closet. No water, no food, no light, no attention. Then remove the bulbs from their pot and plant them outdoors in the ground this fall, like right around Halloween. if you properly fed and sunned the leaves, they should have absorbed enough energy to bloom again next spring, and maybe every spring thereafter, becoming a symbol of your everlasting love.
Okay, so that's rose and tulip lore. Are there other plants of romance in the floral code?
Absolutely. A mixed batch of carnations sends a very nice message, symbolizing a love that is pure and deep. But stay away from single colors like yellow, which equates to disdain, and purple, which means that you're capricious. Chrysanthemums in general equal lovely, but avoid the color yellow or, quote, slighted you will be. Red currants, tasty little fruits that are available fresh at this time of year in upscale supermarkets, are sweet and naturally red, and your bestowing them as a gift translates to your saying, "Thy frown will kill me," which I'm pretty sure is meant to be romantic. Oh, and if you're looking for that little shades of gray touch, the white snowball viburnum is floral code for bound.
Indeed.
Well, that sure was some interesting information about the floral code, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail and not screw up on Valentine's Day, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to give me yellow flowers if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include a bouquet of right-colored roses and your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you will find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website well coded. Linguistic Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Properly potted Al Banks is our editor. Our still brand new intern is Michael Inglaze. I'm your same old host, Mike McGrath. And you know, I think I could really use a pawpaw right about now. But because it's February, I'll have to settle for seeing you again next week. What can you really expect a greenhouse to do for you? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll explain how the best ones can give you a happy harvest, while the cheap ones will just give you spielkes. Plus your fabulous phone calls.